Bird flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life.
This is Our American Stories, and for the hour, cover songs. We saw Rolling Stone Reader's 10 Best Covers, and we thought, let's do that, and let's pick some of our own. You're listening to the 1965 Broadway musical, The Roar of the Grease Paint, and the song The Smell of the Crowd. And Rolling Stone thought that the version you're about to hear was the best cover of this song and came in at number 10. Here's the Muse singing Feeling Good.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
And that was the Rolling Stone Reader's opinion, but Jesse's Nina Simone singing
Birds
Feeling Good.
Flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
And now we're going to go to number 9, and it's so hard to turn off any Nina Simone song. Yeah, I think Jesse won, too. And originally written for the soundtrack of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, Knockin' on Heaven's Door gave Bob Dylan a much-needed hit after years of being written off as a washed-up 60s folk act.
Anymore. It's getting getting dark, too dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
And then there was the Rolling Stone Reader's Choice. And, well, everybody's covered it. Eric Clapton, U2. But in 1990, Guns N' Roses recorded it for their Days of Thunder soundtrack and introduced it to an entirely new generation. It has been a staple of their live show ever since. And when we come back, we're going to rip through the rest of Rolling Stone's Reader's Choice for Top 10 Covers. Let's go out with Axl, Guns N' Roses, and their cover of Bob Dylan's classic.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on, tell me, baby. In the pond, where the sun don't ever shine. I was shivering all night through.
You're listening to Lead Belly. Where did you sleep last night? We're hitting Rolling Stone's Reader's Choice Best Covers. And let me tell you, I'm a huge Lead Belly fan, and I don't think there are many better singers. But when I saw Nirvana cover this song, one of the last, if not last, songs in that amazing Unplugged in 1990, well, take a listen to Kurt Cobain do this, and anybody who doubted his talent as a singer, not just a writer, well, they had to rethink everything.
Shiver shiver the whole night through. The houseman was a hard-working man, just about a mile from here. His head was found in a driving wheel, on his body shine. I was shiver the whole night shine. I would shiver the whole night through. My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? In the pines, in the pines, where the sun don't ever shine. I would shiver.
You just can't stop that song. It's impossible. And now number 7. Here's the original. It's Dolly Parton's Jolene. That 1973 classic. It's the voice of a desperate woman begging a more attractive woman to not steal her man. Not a single word is reserved for the man in that love triangle, by the way. The White Stripes, Jack White, recorded a snarling, feedback-laden cover in 2000. Let's take a listen.
Please don't take my man. Like a breath of spring, your body sounds like summer rain, and I cannot compete with you, Jolene. And I had to have this talk with you, 'cause my happiness, it depends on you, and whatever you decide to do, Jolene.
And we are covering Rolling Stone's Reader's Pick of the 10 Greatest Cover Songs. And now it's time for number 6. Here's the original, the Isley Brothers, Twist and Shout. In their 1963 LP, Please Please Me, in a single day, they recorded that song. So when it came time for John Lennon to sing a cover of the Isley Brothers' Twist and Shout, near the end of the session, his voice, it was just shredded. He rallied by gargling milk and swallowing cough drops before nailing the song in just 2 takes. This is Our American Stories, the top 10 Reader's Choice covers of Rolling Stone. And by the way, what made this song so special were the raw vocals of John Lennon. He was never happy with them, but that's what made the song special. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories. Rolling Stone readers picked the top 10 greatest cover songs. And that's the original version of David Bowie's The Man Who Sold the World. And then Nirvana. Again, this is the second of theirs in this top 10. And here's their version. Again, MTV Unplugged, 1993. Now we're winding down. We're getting into the top five now at number four. Well, here's the original. Off Sgt. Pepper's. It seemed like a throwaway. And a great throwaway. Take a listen.
What would you think if I sang out a tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing.
And by the way, you rarely heard Ringo sing there on Honey Don't, another rockabilly tune, but very rarely a perfect drummer. But my goodness, every once in a while he'd hit it out of the park as a singer too. But the cover that Rolling Stone fans went for, well, it was one of the most indelible images from Woodstock. Joe Cocker looking so, well, just stoned, he could barely stand upright, belting out this same classic. It was like an old soul standard by the time he was done with it. Take a listen.
Stand up and walk out on me. Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how do you
know?
All I need is my brother.
I will help you.
This is Our American Stories. We're doing the countdown. Rolling Stone readers pick the top 10 greatest cover songs. And there are very few singers who could dominate a lineup like Woodstock's. But he stole the movie. He stole the show. And then you see John Belushi's take, because you know that's all John Belushi wanted to do was be Joe Cocker. You knew it when he did it. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. The final three. When we come back after these messages. This is Our American Stories. You're listening to Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. His career was at a low point when he wrote that song in the early 80s. His label had no interest in even releasing the track or the rest of the songs that eventually came out in his 1984 album Various Positions. The track was a fan favorite, though, but it didn't receive much love until the Velvet Underground's John Cale created a stripped-down piano version for a 1991 Leonard Cohen tribute album. But it was this cover by Jeff Buckley that Rolling Stone readers put in at number three best covers. Here is the remarkable Jeff Buckley, who died a far too early and premature death.
Well, I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah, hallelujah. Faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. And she tied you to her kitchen chair. And she broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah.
And now we're getting down to number two. And here's the original. It's Nine Inch Nails, Hurt. And then in 1994, well, Trent Reznor remembers the first time he saw the video for Johnny Cash's cover. Tears started welling up, he said. I realized it wasn't my song anymore. Let's take a listen.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end. and you could have it all. My empire of dirt, I will let you down. I will make you hurt. I wear this crown of thorns upon my liar's chair, full of broken thoughts I cannot repair. Beneath the stains of time, the feelings disappear. You are someone else. I am still right here. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all. My empire of dirt, I will let you down. I will make you hurt. If I could start again, a million miles away, I would keep myself. I would find a way.
And now, and I don't know how you put something ahead of that. I don't think it's possible. That's hour number one by the Rolling Stone readers. Well, here's the original by Bob Dylan.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth.
And here's the number one, no need for an introduction.
There must be some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Drink my wine, plowman, dig my earth. None will level on the mine. Nobody of it is worth. Hey.
This is Our American Stories, Rolling Stone readers' top 10 greatest cover songs. Take a listen.
Thank you.
This is Our American Stories, and it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, and all the things that matter in life. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale will come to you with their terrific and free online courses. Go to hillsdale.edu. On this day in history, a man you likely don't know was born, but a man you do actually know through his work, behind the scenes to create the happiest place on earth, to make Mickey Mouse, Snow White, and the Seven Dwarfs. That Louis Armstrong song you'll hear later, by the way, that you all know, Zippity-Doo-Dah, well, that couldn't have been possible. To make Disneyland and Walt Disney World all possible. And we're not talking about Walt, because you surely know him. We're talking about his brother, Roy, his older brother, and his partner. And joining us now is our go-to leadership expert, Pat Williams, the author of over 80 books on leadership, including How to Be Like Walt, Capturing the Disney Magic Every Day of Your Life, a book you'll want to pick up. Just go to Amazon. A book that, despite not having Roy in the title, is very much about Roy, too, because Walt's story is Roy's story, and Roy's is Walt's. Pat, thanks so much for joining us.
Very nice to be with you, Lee. Thanks a million.
When you were preparing for this book, was Roy's story what surprised you the most, Pat?
Well, it's a good point. Roy was a vital link to the whole Disney empire, and it never would have happened without Roy. Roy was Walt's older brother. Walt looked up to him, but everybody in the Disney family knew that Walt was the creator. He was the wild-eyed imagination guy, but he needed a steady hand next to him, and that was Roy. Roy was the guy that allowed Walt's dreams to become a reality. Roy was a businessman, and he Walt could have all these ideas, but nothing was going to happen unless money was raised. And Roy was a very, very solid businessman.
And those numbers matter. That discipline matters. I want to trace things back to their childhood, if we could, Pat, and their time together. You tell a terrific story in your book about a pocket knife. Can you share that one?
Help me a little bit with that one, Lee.
Yeah, it's on the day the 13-year-old Roy and the 5-year-old Walter were going for a walk, and Walt spotted something shiny in the street. Mm-hmm. He picked it up and admired it. Roy, look, he said, a pocket knife. And give me that, Roy said, snatching the knife from Walt's hands. Hey, Walt, that's mine. I found it. You're not old enough to have a knife, big brother, Roy said. I'm keeping this for your own good. And I think, you know, there it is almost. It's sort of a symbolic story about this remarkable brother relationship. And, you know, sometimes brothers get together and ugly things happen, Pat. But in this particular case, the brothers, let's face it, they complemented each other, their skill sets.
Well, there's no question. Roy was the businessman. He was solid. He was the inside guy. Walt was the creator. He was the wild-eyed creative genius, and it was a good balance. I've noticed in business when there are two prominent men who make something happen. One is the outside guy, as it turns out. One is the inside guy, the businessman. I see it. I'm very much aware of it here with Amway. Rich DeVos was the creator. Jay Van Andel was the businessman. Hewlett and Packard, the same thing. Ben and Jerry. Then we had, later on, you had Michael Eisner and Frank Wells.
That's right.
With Disney. And then Roy and Walt were the same thing. So it's if you had two creative outside guys, you know, I think you probably would run into some problems. And if you had two businessmen on, you know, inside type, insiders, you know, probably wouldn't have enough juice to have anything happen. So it was the perfect combination of temperament and talent.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, we learned that, too, when we did our hour celebrating the life of Bernie Marcus, the co-founder of Home Depot. Arthur Blank was that inside guy, and it turned out that Ken Langone was the guy who raised the money, and Bernie was the salesman. Bernie was the guy who just sold it through. So I think probably if we started a lot of partnerships in business, we'd find that guy behind the guy or that woman behind the woman or the woman behind the man. But it's generally, life is not a solo effort when building great enterprises, is it? Is it, Pat?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And these two men fit perfectly. Now, they had their problems. You know, they had their struggles. They could get after each other. You know, it wasn't all peaches and cream.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, they truly cared for each other, and they loved each other. And when Walt died, Roy was devastated. You know, just absolutely devastated.
And when Walt died and Roy was left, Pat, and we'll just take this up for a minute here and then maybe take it on the other side, what happened to Roy after that? I mean, what does a guy do when he loses a partner like this? I mean, I find the same thing that happens with husbands and wives who've been so close. What happened to Roy after that happened?
Well, he was preparing to retire. You know, he was ready to wrap it up in his career. But Walt died, and now they had just purchased his land in Orlando and were getting ready for this huge move, and Walt was not there to see it through, particularly the whole Epcot project, which was Walt's baby.
Well, let's hold the thought right there. When we come back, we're talking to Pat Williams about not Walt Disney, but Walt's brother Roy, born on this day in history. More after these messages, and you can hear all of our This Day in Histories on OurAmericanNetwork.org. This is Our American Stories, and joining us, Pat Williams, co-founder and senior vice president of the Orlando Magic, and author of over 80 books on leadership, including How to Be Like Walt, and in there, a lot about these brothers. And today we're celebrating Roy's life, because without Roy Disney, Walt Disney's life, well, it wouldn't have been the same. And Pat chronicles that relationship in his book. Pat, at one point, you were saying it wasn't all daisies, it wasn't all roses. They had some pretty big conflicts. At one point, they didn't speak for quite a long time. How long was that time? And what was going on?
You know, they got upset with each other and just stonewalled each other for a goodly period of time. You know, maybe close to a year, I believe.
Yep.
And they were, and the issues were pretty straightforward. Walt wanted to do everything, you know, that his mind could create. He wanted to put it in, get it into action. Walt had to slow him down. Roy had to slow him down. Roy had to figure out a way to make it all work financially. And many times, you know, they really got after each other. But as I said earlier, they did have a deep love for each other and a deep respect. But we tend to lose sight of the fact Roy was the older brother by about an 8-year age difference. Think about that. And you know, Walt was the little brother, and everybody knew that he was unique. But Roy was there to play the role of the big brother as well, you know, to make sure that the whole enterprise didn't go under because of Roy, because of Walt's flamboyance and his desire to make everything happen.
Yeah, I mean, the good news is Walt's come up with a good idea. The bad news is Walt's come up with a good idea. And Roy's got to be the one to just, you know, he's in the end, he's like the buzzkill, the party kill guy. He's always the one saying no, or sounds like just the responsible guy trying to say, slow down, brother. Slow down, younger brother. I wanted to read something, Pat, that you wrote. And when Walt died, older brother Roy, again, he outlives the younger brother and the more famous brother. And in your book, Disney writer Jackie Spears tells you a heart-wrenching story and a moving story about how Roy took Walt's death. And here's what you wrote. Roy Disney may have been the one hardest hit. Roy had spent nearly all of his adult lifetime looking after Walt. Now Walt was gone. It seemed impossible that Walt could actually die and leave Roy, 8 years his senior, behind. Suddenly, Roy now faced the burden of being the sole custodian of Walt's accomplishments and dreams. Disney writer Jackie Spears, as I said earlier, recalled seeing Roy in the studio parking lot one evening after Walt died. Roy was all alone, walking slowly toward his car. Then he stopped and looked around at the studio he and Walt had built together after the success of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Then he lowered his head, got into his car, and drove off. It was, Spears concluded, one of the saddest things I'd ever seen.
Mm.
And, you know, again, this gets to the nature of the relationship. Yeah, they fought and they spatted, but that Disney worker and writer, she saw what you were talking about, Pat, that love.
Yeah, well, that's a great story.
It is.
And Roy was there, you know, as Walt was dying. But on his deathbed, Walt was looking up at those beaver boards in the ceiling, you know, and trying to describe to Roy, you know, how he wanted Epcot laid out. So even right up to his death, you know, his mind was churning about what he wanted done down here in Orlando. And then Roy felt an obligation to cancel the retirement and help see it all through, you know, down here.
And what a, you know, what, when you think about it, Pat, what a construction project at that late an age in your life, and without the guidance of the inspirational source. What a burden to have to live with. What pressure. And again, that's a testimony to the love. I mean, if these brothers aren't close, there's no way that brother is picking up that mantle. That is one burden to carry, Pat.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it was also Roy who insisted that this park down here be named not Disney World, but Walt Disney World.
Yep.
And that's what it is. I mean, whenever you're come down here to visit, you see the big sign of welcome, Walt Disney World. And Roy was adamant, insisted that take place. So Roy suddenly is now doing the work of two men. And seeing this construction project and helping Disney World get launched, Walt Disney World get launched. And they did. He did it. You know, they got it done. Now, Epcot never became what Walt had envisioned. You know, Walt had envisioned a whole new way of life, a whole new way of living.
Right.
You know, with his Epcot. And that was not to take place. So it became a theme park, really. It became a tribute to different nations of the world and a nice place to visit. It's not filled with rides. The children don't enjoy it quite as much as the adults do. But that's the Epcot that they created.
You know, by the way, in your book, you point out, and this is a staggering number, because even in today's dollars, this is a big number. But in 1971, Pat, a $400 million construction job is positively crazy. And you have a story right after that where you point that out. And it had to do with the dedication and the naming of this, the Walt Disney World. And you wrote, as Roy went to the platform to give his dedication speech, he stopped and looked around as if something was missing. John Hench, who was nearby, heard Roy quietly tell an aide, "Would you go find Mickey for me? We don't have Walt anymore, and Mickey's the nearest thing to Walt we have left." Moments later, Mickey Mouse joined Roy on that platform. Pat, that's just beautiful.
Yeah, well, Walt loved Mickey Mouse. In fact, he once said, "I never loved a woman as much as I loved Mickey Mouse.
Oh, let me play you something, Pat. I think this will touch you, and I want the audience to hear it, too. The celebration of Roy Disney's life we need to celebrate by tuning into this dedication of Walt Disney World, a dedication to his brother, and hopefully someone celebrated Roy there, too, for once again making Walt's wildest dreams come true. Let's take a listen.
Walt Disney World is a tribute to the philosophy and the life of Walter Elias Disney. And to the talents, the dedication, and the loyalty of the entire Disney organization that made Walt Disney's dream come true. May Walt Disney World bring joy and inspiration and new knowledge to all who come to this happy place. A magic kingdom where the young at heart of all ages can laugh and play and learn together. Dedicated this 25th day of October, 1971.
And you wrote here, it's quite a tribute here, Pat, as my friend Peggy Matthews Rose told me, every Walt needs a Roy, and every Roy needs a Walt. Every dreamer needs a doer. Every starter needs a finisher. Every entrepreneur needs an administrator, and vice versa. And again, that gets back to the yin and yang, the personalities, and the teamwork that's required in all leadership and all success stories. Pat, why don't we close out with that thought again and circle back to where we started?
Well, it's a great thought, and it's a great truth that extreme dreams depend on teams. And there's no question that Walt and Roy were a spectacular team. All the millions of people who have enjoyed so much fun and so much entertainment, so much family time together, either here or other Disney parks, Disney movies. It's a wide world, but never lose sight of the fact that it was that Walt and Roy Disney team that made it all happen.
Well, Pat, as always, we thank you for joining us, and we look forward to more on Leadership Series. You know, when we take vacations, we always play these over, and the comments just keep coming. We did John Wooden over the break, and my goodness, it's just we got so much good feedback, and I don't think people can hear enough these stories of how the things we all know that come to be, well, how they came to be. And thanks for your contribution on leadership, Pat, and for all you do.
Thank you, Lee. My pleasure.
You bet. And that was Pat Williams, co-founder and senior vice president of the Orlando Magic and author of over 80 books on leadership, including How to Be Like Walt. On this day in history, Roy Disney was born. More after these messages.
Like that. They told me to play it.
Jesse, did you choose this?
No. God.
Oh, man.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and I have no control here. I have lost all control. Just like at home. Now I can't even go to work and have control. And it's time for our For the Win segment with USA Today and with Nate Scott, and we're playing this really dreadful piece of music from Radiohead to torture Nate, because Nate is a Radiohead fan, and Nate, as always, thanks so much for joining us.
This is beautiful. This is the perfect way to start a segment.
Oh, well, we had to do this to you, Nate, because though you write about sports every day, hey, look, we like other things. Just like Richard Ford, my favorite novelist, his best novel was about a sports writer. Well, you're a sports writer who, obviously, I think probably wants to be a musician. So talk about this record, Nate. What did you think of your boy's new record?
Well, for the record, I was a music writer before I was a sports writer for a long time. So they converted me over here. But my background's in music. Radiohead album, it's fantastic. That song you picked was probably the slowest and the saddest of the bunch, but... I just love this band. They make interesting music. They make stuff that you're not expecting.
That's true.
And I don't know. I just, when you listen to music full time, every band starts to sound the same. And I will say about Radiohead, they don't sound like anyone else.
By the way, Nate, we're going to be doing a segment on Guy Clark in a little bit because Guy Clark died today. And you want to talk about a great writer and more of a conventional, what I would call sort of alt-country writer. Than Radiohead, but a real talent, and we celebrate every kind of music, and we're just joshing with you. I mean, we really spend a lot of time on music and sports here on Our American Stories, Nate, and I just love what you wrote in the column. You said, this is an album that resists easy categorization. It is not a rock record. It's not an electronics record, not really. I hesitate to call this pop music. What it sounds like is someone having an extremely funky nervous breakdown. And I just love that, Nate. I loved it. Hey, let's talk about what's going on in sports. Because, Steph Curry, who everybody loves and follows in this country, and I think he's turning non-basketball fans into basketball fans, did something remarkable by not only winning the MVP, but he did it in extraordinary fashion, Nate. Talk about that.
Yeah, he became the first player in NBA history to win unanimous MVP. Every single voter put him at the top of their ballot, something Michael Jordan never did, something LeBron James has never done, Shaquille O'Neal never did. And I think there are a few reasons that happened, but, it's really exciting for him, and I think it's a cool bit of history that he gets to have.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I did not know that, and I'm a real basketball fan. But, that Michael Jordan never did it, that Larry Bird or Magic Johnson never did it, or that Bill Russell never did it. I mean, that's really extraordinary. And while we're talking about professional sports teams, I want to throw to a clip from the show Family Guy on the topic of, well, this is our next burning topic we're going to hit you with, Nate, stadium food.
I'll take one terrible beer filled up way too high so I spill most of it, and a too long hot dog and a too short bun. And do you have mustard and relish?
Yeah, it's right there between the entrance and the exit to the bathroom.
Perfect. And can I get a bag of unsalted peanuts? You know, something I would never eat anywhere else in the world?
Sure, here you go.
Great, great. I can't wait to have diarrhea in the stall with no door while 20 guys wait for me to finish.
Talk to us, Nate. You know, what we love about For the Win is that it covers everything about sports, including something really important, which is concession food at stadiums. And something remarkable is happening in the city of Atlanta. Talk about that, Nate.
Yeah, they made their food be human being priced as opposed to sports game priced, which I don't know if you've ever gone to a game. You know, you might be able to get into a stadium pretty cheap for cheap tickets, but you get three beers and three hot dogs, and that'll be $60. And the Atlanta Falcons realized it was getting out of control. They've got this brand new stadium, and I don't know if the team's going to be great next year. And so they slashed their prices for concessions. Hot dogs will be $2 each. Sodas are $2 each. Fries are $3. And it's actually just, it's a marketing stunt, of course, but it's a really good step. And I think people are starting to realize, with high-def televisions and all this other stuff at the amenities of home, and why would you go to a game? And I think that stadiums are starting to realize now, like, okay, we can't just gouge the prices. We've got to make this something that people can afford to do.
You bet. And, it's not an accident. I think, Nate, that the man behind this is, and by the way, we did a profile on his, on the president, CEO, president, and co-founder of Home Depot, Bernie Marcus, last week because it was his 86th or 87th birthday. But Arthur Blank, who is a co-founder along with Bernie, owns the Atlanta Falcons. And if there's a guy who understands about brand and brand loyalty, it's the folks at Home Depot. And you're right. If the NFL and all these professional sports teams aren't careful, they can price themselves out of the market.
Absolutely. And, NFL, I think, is one of those. The professional football is an amazing television product. I don't know if it's that great a live event, especially with teams cutting down on tailgating time and limiting tailgating. Why would you go? Stay at home. Cook your own food.
Yeah, and by the way, Nate, I'm in Oxford, Mississippi, which means one weekend you have to come here. Because, look, Ole Miss has a top 10 to top 20 football program every year. But we have always had a number one tailgating program. And I think you got to come down and experience that here sometime.
Can't wait. I love SEC football.
Oh, me too. So you guys wrote about a guy who ran a marathon. And if that wasn't enough, he added two twists to it. Tell us about this Doug White fella that we write about at For the Win.
Yeah, Doug White is a North Pole Marathon, which is, I don't know who these people are. I guess there are those people who kind of want to push themselves to the limit and want to do things that cause pain, and I don't want to do that, but I respect them for it. And Doug White not only ran a marathon at the North Pole or near the North Pole in the Arctic Circle, he dressed up as Captain America and did it. So if there's one thing worse than running 26 miles in the freezing cold, it's doing so carrying a shield. But good for him.
You know,
good
I had a buddy in, I think, 95 or 96. I went to law school with him, and he wanted all of his buddies to go to Central Park and wait for him in the space while he did the New York City Marathon. And a couple of us were watching on TV in a bar, and that was the year some guy dressed up like Gumby and did the whole race dressed up like Gumby.
Yeah.
And Gumby beat my buddy, and he has never lived it down, Nate. Lived it down. The one year Gumby had to be in the heat, and what an embarrassing thing. Hey, talk to us about Nyquist. This horse wins with ease in the Kentucky Derby. Gets a good trip, but my goodness, it looked like they didn't even try, the jockey and the horse. How's it shaping up, and what are people thinking about? Maybe something that hasn't happened in who knows how long. When's the last time there was a Triple Crown winner? 2 years in a row, Nate. Has that ever happened?
Never happened. I knew this horse was a favorite. I'm starting to get good vibes about this horse. Named after Detroit Red Wings players, got that hockey juice behind it. But the Preakness is this weekend. I think that horse can win there. The long distance stakes, you never know. Horses this young, you don't know how they're going to transition to that mile and a half. But my money's on Nyquist this weekend, and from there we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it's true. And by the way, for folks who don't know it, The Kentucky Derby is the mid-distance race. The Preakness is the shorter race where speed matters most. And then comes Belmont, and there's generally a three-week wait because this is a mile and a half. And in horse racing, well, that's forever. Nate, as always, we love you joining us. And we weren't sorry to tease you on your favorite band. We're fans of Radiohead, and we love great music. Nate Scott for the win, and that's FTW.USAtoday.com. That's FTW.USAtoday.com. Nate, thanks as always for joining us. Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Lee.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're pulling for Nyquist because, my goodness, what a great thing for horse racing if we get another Triple Crown winner. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Pipe down, Sling Blade. And you're listening to commencement music. And that means we're doing our commencement speech of the day. All month long, we're doing our favorite commencement speeches. From a while back, right up to the present. Mostly really great ones. But that Duke University commencement speech by that professor was so bad it was great. It was so awful, it was funny. And if you get a chance, go to ouramericannetwork.org and look up that Duke commencement speech. As bad a speech as you could ever hear. Funny. Because he started attacking the audience for not laughing at his stupid jokes. It's never a good place to be. And today we want to focus on a pair of speeches. that Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, and the man behind the empire that Bloomberg is, a billionaire and a heck of a mayor, wherever you stand politically, he got that city to run and work. And the first commencement speech was at Harvard in 2014. And it's quite a speech. And, well, Bloomberg earned his MBA here. And I think people were expecting him to give this pep talk about what a wonderful place Harvard is, given that he was giving the speech at Harvard. Let's take a listen.
In the 2012 presidential race, according to Federal Election Commission data, 96% of all campaign contributions from Ivy League faculty and employees went to Barack Obama. 96%. There was more disagreement among the old Soviet Politburo than there was among Ivy League donors. And that statistic should give us some pause. And I say it as someone who endorsed President Obama for re-election. Because let me tell you something. Neither party has a monopoly on truth or God on its side. When 96% of Ivy League donors prefer one candidate to another, you really have to wonder whether students are being exposed to the diversity of views that a great university should offer. Diversity of gender, ethnicity, and orientation is important, but a university cannot be great if its faculty is politically homogeneous. In fact, the whole purpose of granting tenure to professors is to ensure that they feel free to conduct research on ideas that run afoul of university politics and societal norms. When tenure was created, it was mostly protected liberals whose ideas ran against conservative norms. Today, if tenure is going to continue, it must also protect conservatives whose ideas run up against liberal norms. Otherwise, university research and the professors who conduct it will lose credibility. Great universities must not become predictably partisan, and a liberal arts education must not be an education in the art of liberalism. The role of universities is not to promote an ideology, it is to provide scholars and students with a neutral forum for researching and debating our issues, without tipping the scales in one direction or repressing unpopular views. Requiring scholars, and commencement speakers for that matter, to conform to certain political standards undermines the whole purpose of a university.
Wow. Well, you know, it's interesting that Harvard's clapping, and I think that's a lot of the students. You know, your faculty may be leaning one way or another, but the students get it. I think a lot more students than we know get it. And it was interesting when he pointed out that 96% voted for one candidate. And by the way, whichever side, that's just a terrible number. There were people clapping. There were people actually clapping. It was embarrassing for them. I don't think they know. They don't think they knew he was ridiculing them. Let's rejoin Bloomberg in this really remarkable commencement address at Harvard. Again, he got his MBA there.
Now, I'm sure all of today's graduates have read John Stuart Mill's On Liberty. But just let me read a short passage from it. Quote, "The particular evil of silencing the expression of an opinion is that it is robbing the human race, posterity as well as the existing generation, those who dissent from the opinion, still more than those who hold it." He continued, "If the opinion is right, they are deprived of the opportunity of exchanging error for truth. If wrong, they lose what is almost as great a benefit, the clear perception and livelier impression of youth, of truth, produced by its collision with error." Now, Mill would have been horrified to learn of university students silencing the opinions of others. He would have been even more horrified that faculty members were often part of the commencement censorship campaigns. For tenured professors to silence speakers whose views they disagree with is really the height of hypocrisy, especially when those protests happen in the Northeast, the bastion of self-professed liberal tolerance.
And Bloomberg continues his tear on the illiberal tendencies at many American universities, including Harvard.
This spring, it has been disturbing to see a number of college commencement speakers withdraw or have their invitations rescinded after protests from students and, to me, shockingly, from senior faculty and administrators who should know better. It happened at Brandeis, Haverford, Rutgers, and Smith. And last year it happened at Swarthmore and Johns Hopkins, I'm sorry to say. In each of these cases, liberals silenced a voice, and they denied an honorary degree to individuals that they deemed politically objectionable. This is an outrage, and we must not let it continue. If a university thinks twice before inviting a commencement speaker because of his or her politics, censorship and conformity, the mortal enemies of freedom, win out. And sadly, it's not just commencement season when speakers are censored. Last fall, when I was still in City Hall, our police commissioner was invited to deliver a lecture at another Ivy League institution, but he was unable to do so because students shouted him down. Isn't the purpose of a university to stir discussion, not silence it? What were the students afraid of hearing? And why did administrators not step in to prevent the mob from silencing speech? And did anyone consider that it is morally and pedagogically wrong to deprive other students the chance to hear the speech?
So well said. And here is how Bloomberg closed out this remarkable and, I think, courageous speech to his alma mater, Harvard University.
Now, I know this has not been a traditional commencement speech, and in fact, it may keep me from passing a dissertation defense in the humanities department. But there is no easy time to say hard things. Graduates, throughout your lives, do not be afraid of saying what you believe is right, no matter how unpopular it may be, especially when it comes to defending the rights of others. Stand up for the rights of others, and in some ways, it's even more important than standing up for your own rights. Because when people seek to repress freedom for some, and you may remain silent, you are complicit in that repression, and you may well become its victim. Do not be complicit. Do not follow the crowd. Speak up and fight back. You will take your lumps, I can assure you of that. You will lose some friends and make some enemies. I can assure you of that, too. But the arc of history will be on your side, and our nation will be stronger for it.
Great words of wisdom. And 2 years later, well, he was at the University of Michigan and talking about a few things that weren't really even things just 2 years before when he made that speech at Harvard. And it shows just how rapidly campuses have ramped up their liberal tendencies. Here's Bloomberg.
The fact that some university boards and administrations now bow to pressure groups and shield students from these ideas through safe spaces, code words, and trigger warnings is, in my view, a terrible mistake. The whole purpose of college is to learn how to deal with difficult situations, not to run away from them. A microaggression is exactly that, micro. But in a macro sense, one of the most dangerous places on a college campus is the so-called safe space, because it creates a false impression that we can isolate ourselves from those who hold different views. We can't, and we shouldn't try.
Boy, they didn't like it. Some of the students didn't like what Michael Bloomberg was saying.
You are not saying a word.
But this idea of safe zones and microaggressions is crazy. And let's again rejoin Bloomberg for his concluding message to the University of Michigan graduates this year.
Democracy is fragile, and demagogues are always lurking. When Ben Franklin was leaving the Constitutional Convention, a woman approached him and asked, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And Franklin replied, a republic if you can keep it. Well, graduates, it is now your responsibility to keep it.
And great words of wisdom, a great quote, and two terrific speeches. Google it. Put on Bloomberg and Harvard, Bloomberg and the University of Michigan. Share it with all of your friends. What's happening at campuses is just a bit crazy. Safe zones, microaggressions, not good for the kids, not good for the adults, not good for the country. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to hear all of this.